This is Mark Levine. We're devoting two full hours on what's going on in Iran and what Western policymakers can or should do about it. Coming up next is Matthew Brodsky. He is the president and the director of policy at the Jewish Policy Center, the editor of InFocus Quarterly. Matt, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Good to be with you. How are you doing?
I'm good. So you heard, I think, just the last bit of my last guest, Jamal Abdi, and he insists that Iran has not developed the material necessary to build a nuclear weapon, and crucially, and this is the question I asked him at the very end, which I believe you heard, that he believes, and he says that our national security director, national intelligence director, James Clapper, said before Congress, we would know if they started to get to that last final step. Did you agree with that?
Who would actually be comfortable with that? I mean, does anyone actually trust American intelligence so much that we would be able to know that? And that seems like an awful risk to take. So, I mean, that should not make anyone feel better. I'm sure it doesn't make the United States or our European allies feel better. I'm not sure that that makes any of our Arab allies. It doesn't make Israel feel better.
What is the danger of a nuclear Iran?
Well, as the leading state that sponsors terrorism around the globe and supporting Hezbollah and propping up the regime of Bashar al-Assad, which has now killed over 70,000 people, the idea that they could export nuclear technology, nuclear weapons, is very real. Now, when you match their rhetoric with their actions, and the rhetoric is to wipe Israel off the map, you realize that that would be a very bad idea to allow them to have a nuclear weapon. That should be a non-starter, and that clearly should be the goal of American foreign policy vis-a-vis Iran.
Now, Iran says that they're not pursuing a weapon, and that they want it for peaceful purposes, and that it's about their pride that they should. Well, everyone else has a nuclear weapon. Israel has a nuclear weapon. Pakistan has one. Why can't they have one too?
Well, if what they want, well, okay, those are two different points. One is, do they want a nuclear weapon? I believe yes. On the first part, though, if they're saying that they don't want a nuclear weapon, they just want the technology and they want to use it for, say, medical isotopes. Well, that's something that they could do by having the enrichment take place outside of Iranian soil. So, I mean, it's not credible. Not to mention the degree or the extent to which they would like to enrich the uranium, upwards of 20%, is just not necessary for anything other than military or nuclear weapon purposes. So it's quite clear that what they're after is a nuclear weapon. And as to why they should not have a nuclear weapon is, if they're the greatest sponsor of terrorism and literally are just supporting every form of terrorist regime that's in the Middle East and even in Latin America, this is not a group that the United States can stand to have a nuclear weapon or that technology.
Okay, but what are the alternatives? We have sanctions. They appear to be working at least to the extent of harming the Iranian economy. The rial has dropped in value by 70%. Apparently, Iranians can't buy any imported goods. Can we have stronger sanctions, or is the only possibility to resort to military force?
Well, we certainly could have stronger sanctions. And again, we wasted 3 years and again took a pass at the whole helping out during the Green Revolution, as I think you were mentioning before, the 2009 election
right.
aftermath. So that was when, as soon as Obama became president, he could have gone with sanctions and used carrots and sticks. Instead, we're doing only carrots.
It's funny because Jamal Abdi says we're using only sticks. His point is that we haven't tried enough diplomacy, that we were too quick to use sanctions, and he felt that Iran would have agreed to the Brazilian-Turkish deal to do exactly what you say, to move their highly enriched, or I won't say highly, let's say middle enriched uranium out and bring in the stuff they would need for health purposes. But he said that the United States didn't take that deal when it was offered, and that that would have been the solution back in 2010. What's your view on that?
Well, he was also talking about how sanctions have been ineffective or effective. The problem is that they are effective if the metric you're using is how they are affecting the Iranian people. And the problem is they're having a great effect on the Iranian people. As you said, the rial has dropped off, just took a nosedive. But is that affecting the regime's calculus when it comes to its nuclear program? And the answer is an emphatic no. So, yes, we can have more sanctions, but the idea that sanctions alone are they're the one element that's going to just change the calculus of the regime, it's proven not to be the case. Furthermore, sanctions over time have shown to disintegrate. So the sanctions, even if they were really, really strong, if they kept going for a few years, if Iran couldn't get a weapon, say, within a year, they would still deteriorate because other countries wouldn't be able to keep up with it. They would, you know, it's the same thing that happened in Iraq for you know, the whole decade of the 90s.
Let me ask you this. You're the director of policy for the Jewish Policy Center, and obviously one of the things I'm sure you're concerned with is the well-being of the Jewish people around the globe. Israel has said that Iran poses an existential threat, in other words, a threat to its very existence. Iran responds that Israel poses a threat to Iran, that Israel has nuclear weapons, and that Iran fears Israel, and that Iran needs nuclear weapons because Israel has nuclear weapons. How is someone who is not Israeli, not Iranian, not Jewish, not Muslim, how are they to evaluate these statements?
The Israelis?
Well, both. Well, I mean, because they're both hurling pretty much the same claim at each other, aren't they?
Right, but here's, okay, whether Israel does or does not have a nuclear weapon, based on the decades ago that it's thought that they would have had a nuclear weapon, what nuclear arms race did that spur in the Middle East? None.
But so, and Iran would be different.
What's that?
Iran would be different.
Well, Iran is absolutely different right now because now you have Saudi Arabia and other countries that are going to want a nuclear deterrent. So even the idea that if Israel had a nuclear weapon right now, the Arab states and Iran itself knew that Israel wasn't really going to use it, that that's not something that they were going to introduce into the region, and that's been their position, that they wouldn't be the first to introduce a nuclear weapon into the conflict. So Israel having it, a nuclear weapon, if they do, then that's not something that spurred a nuclear arms race. Iran having a nuclear weapon would spur that. So it's...
What threat does Iran pose to Israel?
Well, it is existential, as Israel has said. I mean... And if you go according to the, you know, the needing to bring the hidden imam back in Shia thinking, you know, the idea that some form of Armageddon incident is not such a bad thing. And that's what Ahmadinejad is talking about when he would like to wipe Israel off the map. So, and it's not just a nuclear weapon being launched from missiles or anything like that. It's also giving that technology to Hezbollah, which is their group in Lebanon. And they had already started a war with Israel in 2006. So, and these are very, very real threats that Israel has to take very seriously.
So is it your view that a military strike by either the United States and or Israel is a necessity and it's going to occur and should occur soon?
I'm not saying it's a necessity, but I think we're conducting ourselves right now with one arm tied behind our back. There's no reason you can't have sanctions and you can't have diplomacy, but at the same time have a credible threat of military force. And right now that threat is not credible. There's no reason that the Iranian regime could actually think to itself that the United States is going to do something. We have a horrible messaging problem. We don't even know what our red line is. I heard one of the guests before speaking about, like, what is the red line? This administration doesn't have a red line. So Iran can't figure out what a red line is either.
So what makes it credible? Saying if you enrich past 35%, I'm just picking a sort of a random number, then there will be a military force used? Is that sort of red line?
That could be. I mean, Netanyahu, prime minister from Israel, went before the United Nations and had a chart with picture of a bomb that said 20%, above 20%. And that 20% enrichment is literally 70% of the effort required to create a nuclear weapon. So it's a little misleading, but that is the point that Netanyahu was trying to make. Once you've enriched uranium to 20%, you have a breakout capacity.
Okay.
And that has to be stopped. So either drawing a line at a specific percentage of enrichment, or you could say at such and such a date, you know, this is it. Like, we're not going to keep talking in circles. It's one thing for President Obama to say that we're not just going to keep talking for the sake of talking. But I don't know anyone who doesn't feel like we're just talking for the sake of talking right now, because the enrichment is continuing.
Some of my prior guests felt that we've been talking about the Green Revolution. And by the way, no one has been supportive of the Iranian regime. I'm glad to say that whatever people's views are on sanctions or military force, all of my guests have agreed that Iran is a repressive, dangerous regime that locks up and mistreats journalists and doesn't give human rights. So I was actually very pleased to hear Jamal Abdi of NAIC talk about the need for representative democracy in Iran. So we all agree on the goal Their argument is that by taking aggressive action against Iran, whether it be sanctions for Jamal Abdi or whether it be military force for Alex Vatanka, that it actually pushes the Iranian people, whether for pride or nationalism or simply they don't want to see their country being bombed, it pushes them to support a regime they would not otherwise support. How do you respond to that?
I would respond to that by saying, okay, number one, that is a real issue. And again, the Iranian people are a great people. And, you know, this is an issue of their regime. If we were to actually be using all of our foreign policy thinking, then we would have done something in 2009. We're not supporting the Green Revolution. So if...
What could you have done? I mean, I watched those pictures. My heart went out to those people. I certainly I would have liked to have seen the president.
We haven't learned from, because we're still doing. It took way too long for us to do even the minimal amount of what we're doing in Syria. And back then, in Iran, that would have been satellite phones, even our information. It's not a matter of, you know, putting troops, doing something militarily. It's supporting those people. So it's allowing them to communicate. We all remember the blackouts of communication, and it was incredibly hard to get information out through YouTube. And this is, we could have helped them with communication. We could help them organize.
Is the Green Revolution dead? Are there embers still left? It definitely seems like there's a lot fewer protests than 2 years ago.
It's still there, but I mean, after you have that uprising, and that, I mean, this predates the so-called Arab Spring.
Right.
And this was something that they rose up and we did nothing. Our messaging was still at that point to the regime. This was something that President Obama changed over President Bush before. It used to be that our presidents would give New Year's greetings to Iran, and they would give it to the people, specifically to the people, and talk past the regime. President Obama came in and was still addressing the regime because he's thinking that through the power of his words alone, he would affect the regime's calculus when it came to nuclear weapons. That didn't happen. So when it comes to working with the people, we have a lot in common with the people. And the people of Iran, I mean, they obviously, as previous guests have said, don't like living under the regime that they have. They would be far better off without it, so we should support those efforts. Unfortunately, by sitting on the sidelines, we helped weaken it, and we're still not doing enough now to help bolster it if we were serious about this.
Many Americans argue that post-Iraq, we just don't have credibility anymore, that as Jamal Abdi said, that it's up to the Iranian people to lead their own revolution, and the United States of America is after the invasion of Iraq, if we help, it actually harms the cause of democracy because it's seen as a foreign influence and not seen as native to the country. I want you to respond to that.
Well, okay. Let's take a look at the example of Syria, say. To begin with, they knew that Iran and Russia are propping up the Assad regime.
Right.
They were hoping for the United States to help. The United States didn't do anything, didn't lead. They just apparently we decided that we were getting confused about what we should do in the Middle East, so we decided to do nothing for a very long time. The Syrians were burning Russian flags and Chinese flags, apparently because they've understood who was backing the regime and who wasn't. They were hoping that we were going to do something. We did nothing. So this is how, I mean, it can go one of two ways. Yes, it can be a damned if you do, damned if you don't, if the United States steps in. But by doing nothing, we've basically declared that we don't have an interest. And essentially, since we're still a world power, we're going to end up having to clean up many disasters, whether we want to or not. That's simply our role in the world, in world affairs right now. So
Now, to be fair, many Americans on the right and the left, you might call them the isolationist wings of both the Republican and the Democratic parties, and they exist in both parties,
right,
say that's not our role to be the world's policeman. That I can hear Pat Buchanan on the right, or I can hear well, there are a number of people on the left,
right.
And then there's interventionists, liberal interventionists. Harry Truman comes to mind, conservative interventionists. How do you make the argument that it's up to the United States to be the world's policeman? After all, you know, Iraq, I think many Americans think, didn't go so well.
Well, I'm not saying that we have to be the world's policeman, but what I am saying is that we have a role that even Hillary Clinton, I believe, said before Congress, right before she left her Secretary of State position, was that if the United States doesn't lead, there are consequences. I'm paraphrasing, but something like that. That is very true, but we're the one that the world turns to. So there are going to be consequences when we don't get involved. So this isn't, I mean, one can argue about whether we should or shouldn't, but that doesn't deal with the reality that we are, period.
Well,
we can say that we don't want to, but they're going to turn to us, and then we are going to have to do something. And there's not it's not like you can turn to Europe. Like Europe, look at France dealing with Mali. They can't actually take care of a military situation. They don't have strategic lift. They need the United States military, even in a background role. There simply isn't another country that can do what we do.
Didn't Europe lead the way in Libya, and we followed, and it got rid of the Gaddafi regime?
Incidentally, and that probably turned out to be a mistake, because that happened at the exact same time that the protests started in Syria. And if the United States were taking a realistic look at who Americans' enemies are, you would look at Syria and say, well, they are a charter member of the State Department's list of terror-supporting states since 79. That's an actual enemy. It's in our interest to make sure that the Assad regime falls. That would have made sense. Gaddafi, a problem from the past. Not a current problem. We just haven't done a really good job of figuring out what our priorities are.
Maybe Libya is low-hanging fruit. It has less of an air defense. It's mostly a desert with just a few cities along the coast. It seems easier to knock off the Gaddafi regime than in Syria. And Syria would be middle-hanging fruit, with Iran being, to really push this analogy too far, fruit at the top of the tree. I mean, an extremely difficult country.
Okay, that would make sense. So then it's puzzling, isn't it?
I mean, we're not going to attack China. China has invaded Tibet. The people of Tibet are ruthlessly repressed by China, and China is extremely powerful, and no one is suggesting freeing the people of Tibet, although I think we could all agree that we'd love to see Tibet be a free country. At some point, doesn't it become too difficult to intervene?
At some point, does it become too difficult to intervene? In Syria, yes, we've made it more difficult.
And Iran's even more difficult, isn't it?
Exactly.
So is that an argument then for a containment rather than an attack?
Well, I'm not advocating an attack, but the idea that you can contain a nuclear armed Iran it doesn't make sense. But
why if we contain the Soviet Union, we're containing China. I don't know if we're containing North Korea or not, frankly. I can't figure out what's going on there. How is Iran different from those cases?
The Soviet Union and the United States had a red line, literally like a telephone line, where if something was going to happen, they could call each other and speak. No such communication exists between Iran and the United States, or Iran and Israel, or Iran and any other country that might want to get a nuclear weapon to defend against a nuclear armed Iran.
I guess the heart of my question is, how is Iran more dangerous or expansionist than, say, the Soviet Union or China or for that matter, North Korea, which seems to be lunatic fringe right there?
Simply put, because mutually assured destruction, which worked with the Soviet Union, is not something that prevents Iran. It's an inducement. That's not for the regime, that form of Armageddon scenario is acceptable.
So
that's not for Russia.
It sounds like the heart of the disagreement then is between you and, say, Alex Vatanka, my first guest, is his belief that the regime would not be willing to have some kind of Armageddon, because he says the regime wants to maintain the power that they've put in place for 30 or 40 years, and your belief that the Iranian regime might just push the button.
Okay. Here's an important distinction. If they're trying to get a nuclear weapon right now, Iran, as most people I would say believe, look at their actions without having a nuclear weapon. When they try to assassinate an ambassador in Washington, you know, blocks from where
Saudi ambassador, they tried to kill him.
Right. So, these are their actions without a nuclear weapon. Now, if they have a nuclear weapon so that they can do whatever they want and then simply have that as defense, yeah, they don't actually need to use a nuclear weapon. That they don't have to use it. But it would change their entire their structure. The way that they support terrorism is that that is something that would just be unchecked at all. So to have that former regime, again, nuclear weapons, how much does the United States care that France has a nuclear weapon?
We don't care at all.
Right. Okay, so the problem is which regime has a nuclear weapon. So a regime that is dedicated to everything, that is dedicated to being against everything that we are for, is something that, you know, we don't want them to have a nuclear weapon.
Is the United States even capable of taking out Iran's nuclear weapon program? Many people say they have the know-how, it would only delay it a year or two. And then as a follow-up, if it's difficult for us, I assume it would be even more difficult for Israel.
If a military action had to be taken, it would be far better for the United States to do it. Their capabilities are unmatched in the world. But I think a lot of the problem in the argument that it would just stall the program for a year is, yes, but the same thing was said about Iraq when Israel went against the Osirik reactor in 81. It was thought that that would only break the system and break their enrichment process for a nuclear program by a year. But that was enough.
And of course, Israel took out Syria's nuclear incipient nuclear program just 2 or 3 years ago.
2007. Exactly.
And of course, it would be hard to imagine Syria, which is in the throes of an extremely violent revolution, if someone had access to nuclear power. So
exactly. So you never know exactly what if you do something militarily that's not extreme, that doesn't take out every single centrifuge. That would be a daunting task, but it can still affect the regime's decision-making as it affected Hussein's decision process in Iraq.
But if there is an attack, no doubt it will lead to not just worldwide condemnation as unprovoked, but also Iran has threatened to retaliate and to support even stronger missile strikes into Israel and attacks on American and Jewish targets all around the globe. Isn't this the beginning of an all-out war?
Iran, this is, if Iran's acting like this is their restrained self, then that should bode scarily for the future, wouldn't you think?
Well, aren't they restraining themselves to some extent? They're not in all-out war,
right? But that's not in their interest right now. Their interest is to get a nuclear weapon and then show that they have that in their back pocket. Whether they wanted to use it or not, it would change the whole calculus of the region and again start this nuclear arms race. So,
do you think if the United States does not take military action in the next year or two, that Israel will do so?
That's really tough to say, and obviously I'm not in the
You're not speaking for them. I understand right. That, and I'm not asking you to speak for them. I'm asking you just as an analyst what your thoughts are.
I would say that we could probably look forward to more scientists disappearing or exploding randomly.
Things like the Stuxnet virus.
Exactly. These type of things that would keep whatever red line that has yet to be defined, as I'd mentioned before, that would just keep that can going down the road.
If you were president of the United States, what would you advocate? What specifically do you think President Obama should be doing now? Okay, he's made the mistakes he's made. We can't change what happened in 2009 or even the deal in 2010. What should the president and Congress be doing right now to help resolve the situation?
If the Iranian regime, and this seems to be the case, and I think most people agree, if their number one interest is to remain in power, then they need to feel that there is a threat to them, and currently we don't have one. So we can talk about sanctions, but unless they actually believe that we would do something militarily, whether we did so or not, unless they believe it, their calculus isn't going to change. The way that they make decisions is not going to change, and they will still think that getting a nuclear program is good.
Are you saying we can't threaten the regime in any significant way without military force? No sanctions?
The threat of military force would include putting a carrier group back there. I mean, to begin with, we can't send mixed messaging. We can't have a Defense Department official going out like last year and saying that we really couldn't do anything militarily against Iran, and then having someone the next week say that we could do something against Iran. So it doesn't look like we actually could do anything. If the Iranian regime doesn't believe we can do anything, then why are they going to change their behavior?
So two questions come to mind. The first is, do you think that any non-military action could be enough to persuade the regime? Any kind of stronger or smarter sanctions, could they work, or do you think that's just a fool's errand?
I believe yes, but I also believe that having an aircraft carrier group near the Persian Gulf and to be talking the talk of, you know, we're prepared to do anything, and having that sound credible is a part of diplomacy.
Well, what would be the smarter, stronger sanctions that you would advocate?
For sanctions right now, I think they are already working. I don't think that they're going to work in the time frame that we're looking for. If it's supposed to be a year, and yes, every year it's going to be another year, everyone says, every analyst, until Iran can get a nuclear weapon. I'm not sure if for sanctions we can first impose the sanctions that we already have, and we need to then hold other countries accountable that are breaking them, and we need to stop issuing passes to other countries to skirt the sanctions. And again, as I said before, I still don't think that that's going to be enough to change the decision-making process in Iran.
So you want the credible threat of military force in the region. But, of course,
it has to be credible.
Some say that if Iran sees a credible threat of military force, they'll even rush to enrich even faster.
Right, but from that argument perspective, then the United States can do nothing, period. Like, there's an argument then that, well, if that's the damned if we do, damned if we don't approach, which, again, yeah, we have to select a policy and then enforce it. We have to look after our own interests.
I tell you, I didn't ever said there were easy answers. Right. It's a lot easier to ask hard questions than to give easy answers. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Matt Brodsky, thank you so much for coming here on the Inside Scoop and sharing your opinion with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
All right, coming up.